Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of Rompod. I am your host, Amanda McCall. Are you ready to share the love? The show notes for each episode at rompod.com contain links to this and other stories by our featured authors, all of whom have generously agreed to share their stories with us for free. Please support them in any way you can, like exploring more of their work. This week's story is an historical piece by Marsha Canham called What the Heart Sees. It is part of the Masters of Seduction anthology. It is Marsha's first ever foray into the short fiction style, and as she usually takes about 100 pages to fully introduce her characters, she said, and I quote, "Writing a beginning, middle, and end in under 50 pages gave me a new appreciation for authors who regularly write short stories and novellas." Marsha has written several series, A Robin Hood Tale, a Highlander series, and Dante Pirates, as well as several standalone books. She's had many nominations from RT Book Reviews and finally won in 2003 the Best Historical Romance Adventure Award for Iron Rose, which is a violent, sexy, rip-roaring tale of adventure on the high sea. You can purchase Marsha's works on Amazon, Smashwords, Sony, iTunes, FictionDB, Barnes & Noble, Booktopia, Random House, and like her on Goodreads and Facebook. Follow her on Twitter, MySpace, and Pinterest. Check out her website, which includes up-to-date information on her writing projects, downloads, and much more. And finally, her blog can be found at marshacanham.wordpress.com. Marsha also has a side business of making cover designs, so for you authors out there, if you're interested in very reasonably priced cover art, check out the cover designs section on Marsha's website. This week's story is narrated by yours truly. It is a very long piece, and in future, please let me know if you would prefer me to split stories of this length in half. Let me know via email or in the comments section on rompod.com. Two more things, I promise. I apologize in advance for the terrible accents in this recording. The author has written the accents into the prose itself, and so you hear them in your head when you read them to yourself, and I couldn't help trying them out. Sorry. Really, you have my permission to laugh at my expense. And finally, this story contains explicit scenes and is intended for mature audiences only. Now, without further ado, sit back, grab a glass of your favorite beverage, and enjoy. What the Heart Sees by Marsha Canham. Chapter 1. Lincolnshire, England, 1193.
Archers up!
The cry went from man to man along the castle battlements. The foresters roused themselves from a weary doze and scrubbed their eyes with fists. Most were hooded against the early morning drizzle, though it was barely thicker than the puffs of breath that misted around their faces. They reached for bows, thinking another alarm had sounded, but as there were no missiles whistling overhead, they eased back and looked instead at the master-at-arms who had made the call. He stood at the top of the steps that led from the east tower down to the lower rooftop of the keep. He was armoured, coiffed, and wore a steel helmet with a thick nasal that hid most of his features. Cassie stretched to ease the stiffness that came from dozing against a solid stone wall. Like the others, she took up her bow as she stood, a fine, strong weapon of English yew. Unlike the others, who had left their bow strung, she bent the shaft and twisted the flax string until it was as tight as a horse heart, then fit it snug to the notch. A quick glance confirmed the supply of arrows within reach. Omfrey de Cor was a persistent bastard. She had to hand him that. This was the third call to arms since dawn. Tempers among the defenders were growing frayed. Bellefontaine had been under heavy siege for 3 weeks now. De Cor had been sent by Prince John to oust Lord Thomas Purefoy from his stronghold, a task which was proving to be not as easy as the router had come to expect. Four of the neighbouring demesnes had succumbed with barely any resistance, their lords dragged outside the shattered gates and forced to kneel to their conqueror, whereupon they had been hanged and burned. The crime? daring to question the regent's right to levy taxes and scutage in a land already reeling from starvation and poverty. That he did so under the guise of raising the ransom demanded for the Holy Roman Empire for the return of King Richard, held hostage these past 6 months, fooled no one. Not even the poorest crofter believed a single copper groat would end up anywhere but in the treasure box of John Lackland. Those who protested or spoke out against the unlawful levies found their castles assized, their walls breached, their villeins burned out of their cottages and slaughtered as they ran. On a clear night, from the top of Bellefontaine's battlements, distant orange blooms against the darkness had marked the fates of the neighbouring baronies. Bellefontaine itself was situated on the western border of Lincolnshire, a massive structure. Situated on the top of a hill, it boasted a large, sprawling keep with towers at each corner. To reach that keep, attackers had to breach a 7-foot-thick outer wall guarded by tall barbican towers and a gate comprised of several layers of solid oak banded with iron. De Corks had left Bellefontaine to the last, for it was the largest and least accessible castle within his purview. A sheer drop into a steep ravine protected the northern walls, while a vast, cleared field, several hundred feet wide, made it impossible to approach the other three walls unseen. At the outset, De Corks had boastfully declared it might take him 2 days rather than the one to raise his pennon over the keep, but, so far, he had been throwing his forces against the walls for 22 days and nights with little to show for it. Cassie peered through the crenellated teeth of the battlement. De Corks's men had burned the village the first day. The small, neat crofters' cottages had been spread around the base of the hill, secure in the shadow of the castle walls. The mud and wattle huts were broken now. The thatched roofs had become gauntlets of flame in the night attack, and all that remained were charred heaps of rubble. Cassie and her father had lived at the edge of the village closest to the forest. Her dark green eyes often looked longingly at that dense ring of greenwood. The trees so thick in places a man could not see his hand before his face. There had been an instant in time, a moment following the sound of the alarm bells when she and her father could have chosen to run for the forest rather than take shelter behind the castle gates. The woods were filled with bands of men, outlaws now by decree, who had fled before the burnings and killings. William Fletcher would have been welcomed into any of these vagabond troops, for like the name he bore, he was a Boer and Fletcher. His longbows, which stood as tall as a man, were made of carefully seasoned, straight-grained yew, and were nigh on unbreakable. Cassie had held one to hand since she could waddle upright on her own, and thus she had become his testing piece for new designs, slimmer grips, stronger arrows. Every archer who defended the castle walls had benefited from William's expertise and Cassie's skill, for who among them wanted to admit they could not hold their own against a mere slip of a girl? Consequently, Bellefontaine boasted the finest arbalesters in the kingdom, and it was in great part due to these archers that De Cork's men had been held at bay for the past 3 weeks. They had discovered early in the siege that it was wisest to make their camp in the trees and not in the open fields, and to remain behind the tangle of ferns and saplings during the daylight hours. The fields between the wood and the castle walls were littered with fools who sought to challenge this wisdom. Their bodies lay in blood-darkened patches of mud, a dozen or more quills sticking out of each calf and thigh, the only vulnerable places not protected by armour and chainmail. Porcupine legs, the defenders called them. For a while, each wound on its own might not be fatal. A dozen shafts piercing each leg soon caused a man to bleed out. "They have been pounding for 2 days and nights now," said John the Verder from his post beside her. "And look how cocky they grow." Cassie knuckled the last of the sleep out of her eyes and followed John's pointed finger. There was movement at the edge of the trees, though the layer of mist made it difficult to see. Now and then she caught a glint of armour or a splash of colour from a surcoat or gambeson. Most were dark blue, emblazoned in gold, with the arms of Omfrey de Cox, a fox and wolfhound rampant, snarling, claws and fangs bared.
What do you suppose they're building?
Cassie shrugged. They were cutting down trees all week. A Trojan horse, perhaps? John arched an eyebrow.
A horse out of wood?
To present as a false gift, she explained. A tall wooden horse that would appear to be an offering of peace, but with a belly full of soldiers who come out after dark to slay everyone in the castle.
De Corks has done this at other castles?
No. She laughed slightly. No, tis a tale from ancient Greece. A famous battle fought at Troy. I could read it to you sometime if you like. His frown deepened.
Reading is for mendicants and clerks.
Reading teaches you from the experiences of others, some who have lived 1,000 years ago.
1,000 years?
He snorted. De Corks is not that old.
Cassie opened her mouth to comment, but realized it would be useless, and only made her head hurt as much as her body. Coming as a timely interruption, she saw a commotion at the top of the tower steps. A pair of knights had climbed from the wall walk and stood there talking to the masters-at-arms. Cassie's skin flushed, instantly warm, and her belly made a gentle somersault. It was Lord Thomas Purefoy himself, come to inspect his castle's defences, as he had done on several previous occasions since the siege began. He stood half a head taller than any other man on the rooftop. He had a face like a dark archangel with high cheekbones and a square jaw that was clean-shaven in the Norman fashion, in contrast to the Saxon shagginess of his villas and tenants. He was every inch a knight. Broad shoulders and chest were heavy with muscle, as accustomed to wearing 100 weight of chainmail as a forester was to the lightness of a linsey-woolsey shirt. Beneath his burgundy and gold gambeson, Sir Thomas was wearing a short mail hauberk. The links glittered down his arms like the scales of a fish. The tight steel rings of his coif hid the wavy thickness of his hair, but she knew it to be almost blue-black and short-cropped. His long legs were encased in snug woolen hose that showed the shape of every muscle, every sinew. And, as he propped a boot on a wooden cask, the heavy maleness at the juncture of his thighs. Flushing even warmer, she forced herself to lower her eyes swiftly, lest she be caught trying to peek under the hem of his tunic. Admiring the lord of the castle from afar was safe enough, and Cassie had done so on many occasions, but up close, it was an entirely different matter. She could feel the blush staying stubbornly in her cheeks, and she shifted uncomfortably from one foot to the other, feeling other parts of her body affected by wicked thoughts. She was conscious of her own tawdry appearance. Her calfskin leggings sagged from ankle to knee. The coarse wool of her tunic was filthy, having been lived in and slept in for the past fortnight. Her hair was scraped back and hung down her back in a grimy, tattered braid, and her hands, God's teeth, her hands were black with dirt, and shaking like those of a virgin on her wedding night. As discreetly as she could, she slid behind John the Verderer, using his bulk as a shield. With one green eye, she peeked around his shoulder at the vaunted knight as he spoke to the guards and listened to the state of their defences in this quadrant. They had tubs of oil and barrels of pitch that could be boiled and poured over the walls should any of de Corks's men attempt to throw up ladders. The east tower, being furthest from the verge of the woods, they had the best archers culled from the foresters and huntsmen, and a ready supply of arrows. As he listened, Sir Thomas nodded and moved towards the battlements. He walked with a slight limp, the result of an injury sustained while on crusade. He had lost some toes, Cassie had heard from gossips, but by the grace of God, not the whole foot. He had fought at Richard the Lionheart's right-hand side, and that alone, in Cassie's opinion, would have been worth the loss of the entire leg.
It would appear your archers have been keeping de Corks's men well down in his foxhole,
said the knight who had accompanied Sir Thomas to the tower. Cassie leaned a little to see the speaker, for most men in helmets looked alike. She recognized the voice, however. The sound was like two slabs of stone grinding together. Sir Hubert Longsbury was the captain of the castle guard, craggy-faced and stout as a barrel.
Well done, men,
Sir Thomas said, as his sky-blue eyes swept around the battlements.
Our fondest hope is that the Regent's puppet will tire of throwing himself against our walls, and when he does, the victory may be credited, in large part, to those here present.
A cheer went up amongst the archers, for it was not often that knights acknowledged them as being of more use than softening a field before the true army of mounted warriors thundered out to do battle. There would be no thundering out of Bellefontaine, however. There were less than 20 knights inside the walls, and more than 100 outside. Sir Thomas paused by one of the men, who pulled himself up proudly and tugged a greasy forelock in deference. The pale blue gaze had been drawn to the archer's weapon, one of William Fletcher's making, and while, as a knight, he would never deign to carry a bow into battle, he respected its power.
"Sir Hubert tells me some of your arrows have been able to pierce through chainmail. Is this correct?"
"Not mine, sire," said Alfred the Oath. "I can pierce through skin and fur well enough, and mayhap a leather jerkin if it's not too thick, but my arrows are not fit against iron." Sir Thomas tilted his head slightly as Sir Hubert murmured something in his ear.
"The girl, you say? Where?"
Sir Hubert scanned the row of grimy faces.
"Cassandra the Fletcher's daughter, come forward and acknowledge your liege."
Cassie closed her eyes briefly, braced herself, then stepped out of the shadow of John the Verderer.
"Forward, to me, girl."
Cassie obeyed the sound of grinding rocks, and moved away from the wall, feeling the eyes of every man turning to watch. Sir Thomas's brows drew together as she approached, with good reason. The top of her head barely reached his shoulder. She was as slender as the bow she carried, with large green eyes, and a face that belonged to a grimy little cherub.
"Sir Hubert informs me that your arrows are the ones that have been piercing through mail. Is this true?"
Cassie moistened her lips. "They are my father's arrows, my lord. I merely send them on their way."
"And what makes these arrows so keen as to break through iron links?"
She kept her eyes focused on the toes of his boots as she handed him one of the ashwood arrows to inspect. The shaft was as long as her arm, the goose feather fletching smooth and precisely trimmed. It was the tip, however, that varied from the blunt-nosed bodkins that were launched from most of the longbows. Made of twice-tempered steel, hammered flat and honed to a fine point, it could slice through leather like a knife and penetrate all but the thickest plates of Jezeront army. The tip had another fearsome feature, one he acknowledged immediately with his soldier's eye. It was double-barbed, like a fish-hook, and seated loose enough on the shaft that it would come off in the flesh and make even the smallest wound fatal.
"Why do all the men not have these arrows?"
"They take longer to make, my lord," she answered quietly. Sir Thomas narrowed his eyes.
"And he trusts these few to you?"
The words, "a mere girl," went unspoken, but she heard them as clear as the bell that tolled arms. So did the men who knew her temper as well as her skill, and several of them made a sound in their throats, loud enough for Sir Thomas to take note. The blue eyes scanned the faces, and their smiles faded. He looked back at Cassie, noting the two hot spots of colour on her cheeks.
"I detect some champions among your peers. Before I can be convinced, however, I would see a demonstration."
She raised her eyes, then looked calmly, directly to his. "I have but a score of barbed arrows left, my lord. Yet if you would have me squander one by demonstrating that I can pluck an arrow off a tree branch, I would happily oblige." In the immediate silence that followed, Cassie nearly bit her tongue in half. Beside her, Sir Hubert's chest was already swelling like a bladder filling with hot air. His face had darkened and his fists had clenched. He was a tick away from roaring at her insolence when Lord Pufroy chuckled and raised a gloved hand to stop him from sputtering.
"Very well, girl, come with me. I will choose a worthy acorn."
Cassie's knees very nearly buckled, for she realized how close she had come to being flung over the wall by Sir Hubert. Taking two strides to each of his one, she followed Sir Thomas as he retraced his steps across the tower. Down the stone stairs and along the wall walk that skirted the long stretch of battlements, they passed through the second of the four towers that rose above the corners of the massive keep without stopping, and descended again, striding towards the third tower directly opposite to the one where she had been posted. As they climbed the stairs, the heavy thumping sound they had been hearing all night came clearer,
and she was somewhat startled to see it had not come from de Kock's camp at all. It came from the huge wooden trebuchet that was hurling stones at the castle gates. The catapult had been manoeuvred into position at the edge of the field. As she watched, the great beam of the arm was being winched back against the rear wheels, and a large boulder, the weight of which required two beefy men to carry it, was seated into the canvas pouch. Upon a signal, the men backed away, and a lever released the tension in the ropes. The arm swung forward and sent the boulder flying across the 200 yards of charred fields to smash against the thick oak gates. When it struck, she could feel the wall shudder beneath her feet and hear the rubble packed inside the wall shifting with the impact. "The gates are holding thus far," said Thomas quietly, "but the noise grows tiresome. Think you could pluck one of those acorns off the tree?" Cassie glanced through the teeth of the wall again. The men working the catapult were well protected. The iron scales of their long hubrics glittered in the weak morning light, covering them like long gowns from shoulder to foot. Apparently, de Kock's armourer had come up with his own ingenious design to thwart the vulnerability of the porcupine legs. Sir Thomas signalled to Sir Hubert, who had brought some of the barbed arrows with him. Taking one, the Dark Knight smiled gently and handed it to Cassie. "The distance may prove as much an impediment as the armour, girl, and I'll not hold it against you if the acorns go unskewered." Cassie took the arrow and held the piercing blue gaze a moment longer before turning to study the catapult again. It took 5 men to work the war machine, though there were 6 more standing nearby to steady the wheels if they shifted off the blocks. 2 worked the winch, 2 loaded the canvas pouch, 1 released the lever. The latter rivaled Sir Hubert in size and girth, with arms like tree stumps and a form bulked like a small mountain. She suspected the trigger mechanism would normally require the strength of 2 men, but this behemoth was able to handle it with only a bellowed roar as aid. She nodded to herself and wiped the mist out of her eyes. She slipped a leather guard on her fingers and ran the feather fletching between her lips to smooth the flight, then raised the bow and stood sidelong to the wall. She nooked the arrow to the string and rested her hand lightly to her cheek, pushing slowly back on the bow until her left arm was straight, and the tension in the string was at its peak. Sighting along the shaft, she stopped her breath, plucked her fingers free, and sent the arrow on its way. Both knights leaned forward eagerly to follow the hissing flight of the arrow. They saw it streak straight and true to the chest of the behemoth, punching through the quilted gambeson and linked mail. He toppled backwards off his balance, staggering with the force of the blow, his hands clutching for the shaft that was now buried half deep in his chest. As he spun around in disbelief, the watchers on the wall could clearly see the bloody tip of the arrow protruding from his back. 2 stumbling steps and the mountain crashed to the ground. By then, Cassie had knocked and fired 2 more of the barbed arrows, felling the pair who stood by the handles of the winch. The 2 men carrying a fresh boulder towards the catapult dropped their burden and ran for the protection of the forest, but they too were sent sprawling to the mud with arrows jutting from their spines. Cassie lowered the bow and flexed her fingers to ease the tingling. Sir Thomas said nothing for a full minute. He continued to stare at the 5 slain men, part of him wanting to shout with satisfaction, part of him understanding the horror of a weapon that could pierce armour at a distance that offered no possible defence against it. "My God," he murmured finally, "my good sweet God."
"De Kock's will be swallowing his liver,"
Sir Hubert predicted.
"He'll not find too many volunteers willing to take their place."
"Perhaps not, but he still outnumbers us 10-1, and even the strongest of castles can eventually be undermined." Realizing there was a 3rd pair of ears privy to their conversation, Sir Thomas turned to Cassie. "We need more of these arrows. How fast can your father make them?" Hoping for some small crumb of praise for her marksmanship, Cassie held back her disappointment. "He is only 1 man, my lord. Perhaps if he had help..."
"Go to him.
Tell him he will have all the help he needs. The castle armory will be at his disposal as well. The Castellan keeps a ready supply of iron and steel plate in the storage rooms below the keep. He will be told to provide your father with anything he needs. Yes, my lord. She turned to go, but a further command halted her. When you have done this, join me in the great hall. You will take a meal with me that I might praise you properly for your skill at plucking acorns.
Cassie felt a surge of pride course through her veins. Yes, my lord.
Oh, and when you are speaking to the Castellan, tell him to arrange for a bath and some clean garments. I find myself with an appetite for the first time in many weeks, and I'll not be put off by dirty fingers and the smell of an overfilled slops pail. Chapter 2. A courteous way to say you stink like a dung heap, she muttered to herself. She had found her father working in the small smithy located against the wall of the inner bailey. He looked like a moor, covered head to toe in black soot, but he grinned through the grime and sweat when he learned how the lord of the castle had singled out his daughter, how she had proved her skill, and how, now, with men put to hammering and cutting, he would be able to make 100 arrows an hour rather than half a dozen. With neither page nor lackey immediately at hand, he sent her on her way to the vast storage rooms that lay beneath the castle keep. "As many doors of iron as you can carry," he commanded. "Any hammered sheets, if possible, as well. 'Twould save time in the forge, if the iron has been tempered once already." Armed with two large canvas sacks and a horn-sided lantern, Cassie found the covered passage that followed the outer wall of the main keep. She went down a narrow, twisting staircase that uncoiled to the gloomy, cavernous undercroft and had to shake away visions of ghosts and huge, salivating creatures. Tallow candles were set in black crescents, mounted on every stone arch, but the light they produced was weak and flickered in the draughty passage. Some had even blown out, which made for long gaps between leaving one pool of dim light and hastening to the next. The outer walls glistened with dampness and smelled of mould and dankness. The low ceiling was vaulted to carry the tremendous weight of the castle walls, and while she was not considered tall for a girl, Cassie was still forced to duck in places to avoid scraping her head on one of the thicker arched supports. The air was cold, her skin was clammy, her clothes were already damp from the morning dew and drizzle, so the chill struck clear through to the bone. There were so many storage rooms and niches carved into the stone base. She hoped she had not gone in the wrong direction after descending the spiral staircase. The air was close. She had the sensation of the walls pressing in on her, and she imagined shadowy figures lurking behind each archway. She had no idea where the dungeons were. Not that she even wanted to know such a thing, but she knew they must be down here somewhere. And again her mind flared with images of chained prisoners, gaunt from starvation, pale as wraiths. A shudder quickened her footsteps. She came to the end of a wide passage, as her father said she would, and found the narrow door that led to yet another vaulted chamber. Normally there would have been a pair of guards placed on the door, and indeed she saw a table and two small stools to mark their post. Since the siege had begun, all able-bodied men had been sent to the walls, for if the castle fell, there would be no need to worry over what remained of the corn and ale, neither of which were in great supply. De Corks had burned the fields and destroyed the winter harvest. Storage rooms that should have been bursting with sacks of grain, bins of corn, mountains of apple and carrots, all but empty. Cassie heard what sounded like the scrape of a boot on the floor behind her and whirled around, holding the lantern high. Prickles flooded down her spine, caused her knees to knock together. She pressed her lips into a thin line and put a hand to the dagger she wore at her belt. "Is someone there?" Her voice echoed hollowly off the stone walls and bounced around the vacant storage rooms. She heard another sound, and this time her ears were focused enough to identify the shuffling of tiny, scurrying feet. "Rats, for pity's sake," she muttered.
She expelled a long, slow breath and tried to grasp hold of her wits again. "Courage," she whispered to herself. "Courage, courage,
Courage, silly girl. Fetch the iron, take it to father, find the sensual and...
And what?
Take a bath? Put on clean garments? Take a meal with Lord Thomas Purefoy as if it were her right and due? As if it were a common day occurrence for the daughter of a Fletcher to even dream of sitting above the salt? She shook her head and lifted the latch to open the door. It was as black as pitch beyond the opening, and she was thankful now for the lantern. Forcing her feet to move forward again, she focused straight ahead, passing by arched oaken doors, vaulted storage rooms where tournament armor and arms were kept. Cassie's footsteps slowed again. Up ahead was a soft flare of light. It emanated from the gap below and the spaces around a doorway, perfectly outlining the arched shape of the stone blocks. For one giddy moment, Cassie likened the sight to the late afternoon sun sending out streaks of light around a dark storm cloud, or, as a second image took shape in her mind, the shining halo that always surrounded the head of Christ in holy tapestries. The more practical side of her determined that this was the door to the armory where the precious ingots of iron were kept. Raising the lantern above her head, she saw a small carving on the door, a depiction of the moon and several five-pointed stars surrounding it. It was odd for an armory. She would have expected swords and daggers and shields for a carving. She moved forward again, this time letting the metal handle of the lantern rattle by way of announcing her approach if there was someone inside the chamber. To her relief, when she tapped lightly on the door, she heard a voice reply, "Come." The latch moved freely as she lifted it, and the door swung silently open on rope hinges. The room was lit by a brace of candles stuck in pools of their own melted wax, set on a small wooden work table. Seated on a three-legged stool was a hooded figure who partly turned his head to acknowledge her arrival, then went back to his task, humming ever so softly under his breath. "Keep your heels to the floor long enough," he quipped after a moment, "and roots begin to sprout. Come closer. It is almost done." Cassie moistened her lips and stepped inside the chamber. It was apparent upon the first shocked glance that this was not the armory. The top of the work table was littered with tools of a jeweler's trade. A scarred and charred crucible, tongs, files, sand for polishing, buttons and cakes of argentiferous lead. Tiny doors of refined silver, as well as long, thin wires used to shape into filigrees. Hanging on the wall were chains of gold and silver, the candlelight making them glitter and wink with each flicker of the flame. A nearby shelf held goblets and plates stacked elbow-deep, wrought in solid gold. There was more, all of it dazzling and stunning to the eyes accustomed to only seeing wooden bowls and using whittled sticks for spoons. There were sword handles and daggers encrusted with jewels, church plates likely hidden here for safekeeping alongside gold and silver crucifixes. The jeweler's hands were wrinkled with age and thick around the knuckles. His eyes were blackened by years of working with silver and lead, and were moving slowly, rhythmically, as he applied a polishing cloth to the object he held in his palm. "Bring yourself closer, child. I do not often have the pleasure of company." "I'm looking for the armory," she said, staying where she was just inside the doorway. "Ah, yes. I hear the defences are holding well. The regent's taxman is not having so easy a time of it as he had hoped. Lord Purefoy has vowed to keep the gates closed until it snows in hell." The old man chuckled. "Yes, he would say that, just as his father would have done." Cassie's interest was roused, despite her need to find the armory and leave this creepsome place. Sir Thomas's father had died before she and her father had come to settle at Bellefontaine, but she'd heard tales of his exploits with old King Henry II. He had been the king's champion and, though it was only whispered as a rumour, lover to Queen Eleanor for most of the 15 years she had been imprisoned by her husband. "You knew the old master?" The hooded figure chuckled again. "Aye, and his father before him, and his. I crossed the channel with William the Norman, thinking to return home once he had conquered this strange, savage land, but alas, I was needed here and stayed." "The conqueror William?" Her eyebrow inched upwards as she felt an imaginary tug on her leg. "You must be very old then. Old and addled, she thought. Oh, indeed. Verily, I am called ancient by all who know me.
And who knows you? I, for one, have never seen you before, and I have lived in the village these past 10 years or more.
His shoulders shrugged within the cowl.
I live in the forest and come and go without much notice.
Even if that is so, the gates have been closed and barred these past 2 weeks.
Ah, but I have my own gate.
There.
He pointed a gnarled finger at a niche in the wall. A niche that proved to be, once she lifted her lantern to chase away the shadows, a doorway of sorts, waist high and shaped much like a mouse hole.
Do the guards know you come and go at will?
Old Ugly Nose used to know. I made a trinket for his wife so he would keep his tongue between his teeth.
He had still not looked up or turned around. Cassie inched closer. Detecting her curiosity, he lifted the cloth and tipped his hand to the light. Seeing what he had done, what he was so intent on polishing, the breath caught in her throat. Jewels flashed and silver flared, for nestled in his palm was a large silver pendant. The heart of it was an oval-shaped mirror, polished so finely that the reflection was almost as pure as that from glass or water. Surrounding it were vines made from silver filigree. Set in the vines were emeralds representing leaves, and carbuncle diamonds representing flowers.
"God's truth," she said in a hushed voice. "It is beautiful, absolutely beautiful."
"Truly?"
"Truly," she said, "I swear it."
He turned then and smiled up at her. His face was as wizened as his hands, the skin as thin as parchment and wrinkled like berries left too long out in the sun. It was his eyes that caused her mouth to drop open, however. They were completely white, coated with a thick, milky caul that rendered him completely sightless. How he saw enough to create such a beautiful jewel was far beyond her knowledge.
"Would you like to hold it?"
"Me?" She stood a step back at the thought. Once, when very young, she had held a silver coin until her father had smacked it out of her hand.
"Of course you."
"But, oh, I mustn't," she whispered. "I dare not."
"There is no one here to see you, child. Take it, touch it, hold it to your breast. I have done all I can do, but the metal is cold and needs the warmth of a pure heart to give it life."
When she still hesitated, he reached around and took her hand in one of his, uncurling her fingers so that he could lay the heavy jewel in her palm. Almost instantly she felt her skin react, though whether it was from the pendant itself or from the thought of holding something so beautiful and valuable, she could not have said. A tangible warmth started to spread up her arm, tingling across her chest, quivering down into her belly. "The silver comes from Damascus. The gems once belonged to a Syrian prince." "Think it should be a pendant, hung about the neck?" he was asking, "or a brooch, pinned to a comely breast or cloak?"
I have no thought as to either," she stammered,
her gaze locked to the sparkling facets.
"Ah, well, we shall leave it up to the wearer then, shall we? But do look into the heart of it, child. Tell me what you see."
Cassie swallowed hard, and although she did not command her hand to do so, it raised the heavy pendant so that she could see into the polished surface of the mirror. She gasped a little, for the face that shone back at her was her own, yet not her own. In the reflection, her hair was full and shining, tousled about her face in a cloud of sunlight yellow curls. Her large green eyes were wide and calm, her lips tipped at the corners as if sharing a secret smile. Her throat was slender and bare, and she was wearing a gown made of exquisite burgundy silk, brocaded with thread of gold. The very jewel she was holding lay against the bodice, and, reflected in the oval mirror, was the face of a man who was handsome beyond all decency, a man who looked shockingly like Lord Thomas Purefoy. She squeezed the pendant so hard she felt a sharp prick on the fleshy part of her thumb. It was enough to draw a tiny bead of blood and to bring her senses crashing back to earth. She all but threw the pendant back on the work table, then wiped her hand down the front of her tunic over and over, trying to rid her palm of the burning impression the jewel had left.
"What did you see?" the jeweller asked, sensing her distress. "Nonsense," she whispered. "I saw nonsense." He smiled. His hand groped a moment across the table until his fingers located the pendant. "What you saw was your own heart, child. You saw your heart's fondest desire." Cassie backed up towards the door. "My fondest desire is to find the armory and return to the bailey before I am missed." "Of course, of course. I have delayed you long enough. I bid you Godspeed, child, in everything you do." "You as well, sir." She started back out the door, but paused and looked back. I did not ask your name." "Godfrey," he said, turning slightly. "I am called Godfrey the Lombard." "Be well and safe, Godfrey the Lombard," she said, and left him to his work. Cassie found the armory duly marked with a carved shield on the door, and returned to the smithy with her sacks filled with iron for the arrowheads. William was pleased to find several small squares of hammered steel as well. He had already culled men from the walls who were familiar with fletching and tipping, foresters and huntsmen for the most part, all of whom he set to work at once. Cassie would have preferred to remain with them and make the arrowheads, but she departed reluctantly and found her way to the bathhouse. It was located in a cluster of outbuildings near to the scullery and bread ovens, used mostly by huntsmen and visiting knights to refresh themselves before being presented to the lord. The tub was metal, lined with wood, and sat on a raised platform under which fires were kept burning to keep the water hot. It was large enough to accommodate 5 or 6 big men at a time, but at the moment there was only Cassandra and another older woman she knew as Nosy Rosie in the hut. "I'll take them rags of yourn, dearie," Rosie said, wrinkling up her nose, which was prodigious enough to have earned her the nickname. "I've orders to see you clean and presentable, a term you could use to describe out your wearin' at the moment." Cassie hugged her arms across her chest, protecting the leather jerkin from the fat hands that reached for them. "What are you going to do with my clothes?"
"Burning would be my first choice," Rosie declared, "but leave go of them for now, and I'll see they're washed and hung out to dry in the sun."
Warily, Cassie lowered her arms. She had but one pair of leggings, one tunic, and one shirt, and could ill afford to have any of all three burned or lost.
"God's truth, girl," Rosie said behind her, unplaiting the tangle of hair as Cassie unlaced her shirt and leggings and set them aside. "You've got a whole family of creatures living in here."
She clucked her tongue and shooed Cassie into the hot water while she went and found some harsh soap. It was only the second time in her life that Cassie had bathed in a proper tub. Usually she made do with a bucket and cloth, or washed in a nearby icy stream. Heating water was an unheard-of luxury. As she sank up to her shoulders in the warmed water, she smiled. This must be why the noble men and women had such white skin and smelled so sweet. She splashed her hands across the surface and carried water to her shoulders and neck, thinking she felt quite regal in a genuine, real hot bath. A large, fat hand covered her head and pushed her, sending her down under the surface of the water. It held her there while she thrashed and sputtered, and her lungs were emptied of air. The hand let her come up again, but only long enough to pour something horrid and smelly in her hair, give it a rub, then dunk her under again.
"Lice," Rosie declared. "You'd not want to see them hoppin' from your head to his lordship's pigeon pie, now, would ye?"
Cassie was still swearing, still sputtering. Her eyes were stinging from whatever Rosie had poured onto her head, and now it was compounded by yet another concoction that was rubbed and scrubbed into her hair 6 times, before being rinsed and scrubbed again. By the time Rosie declared the waist-long mass bug-free, her scalp was on fire and she was fuming, close to tears. "Do you need help scrubbing your nether parts, or can you manage that much on your own self?"
"Myself," Cassie gasped. "I can manage myself."
"Good. Here's the soap. Here's the cloth. I'll be checkin' when you're done, so no sense just ticklin' over your hide and callin' it clean."
Cassie glared, but the woman simply put her hands to her hips and glared back. In the end, she soaked and scrubbed and rubbed her toes and fingernails with sand. She soaped her face until she was sure her freckles had come off, then stood and allowed Rosie to pour a bucket of water scented with lavender oil over her hair and body. Following a harsh drubbing with a towel, she sat in front of the fire and endured another round of cussing while her hair was brushed and dried. A plain white linen sheath was dropped over her head, followed by a tunic of pale green damask. Long sleeves were laced to the shoulders, and a narrow braided rope of silk threads went around her waist, tied so the tasseled ends fell straight down to the middle, almost to the floor. There were no polished steel mirrors in the bathhouse, so she had no idea what she looked like, and she was too busy looking down, admiring the soft green slippers that peeked from beneath the hem of the gown, to notice the expression on Rosie's face. When she did look up, the woman's frown was sternly back in place. "Have a care not to drip grease on the frock, or wipe your mouth on the sleeve. Try to walk like a lady, shoulders back, chin up, titties out, and no stomping about like a woodcutter's oaf. Speak only when you're spoken to. Don't pick your nose, or fart, or scratch anything, and for pity's sake, don't swill more than a mouthful of wine, or you'll end up on your back, with your legs in the air, before you can blink." Cassie repeated her orders and nodded. Her belly was full of butterflies, and her hands were shaking as she followed Rosie into the keep. Despite having lived most of her life in the village, she had been inside the Great Hall but 3 times. On those occasions, she had been conscripted along with every other girl above the age of 10 to carry and serve food to a throng of guests. There had been no cause for great feasts held at Bellefontaine these past few years, so her memories were more of running hither and thither with plates of meat and fowl, staring in awe at the knights and their ladies in their colourful garments, while avoiding their huge snapping wolfhounds who attempted to snatch whole chickens off her tray. Now she stood at the arched portal at the rear of the hall and felt her knees quake anew. It was a large, imposing chamber, with tall stone walls that stretched 3 stories up to a maze of arched beams that crisscrossed the vaulted ceiling. Lacking windows below the level of the 2nd story, light was provided by a score of tall iron stands that seated a dozen or more fat wax candles. Fires blazed at either end of the hall in the hearths large enough to hold 1/2 a tree trunk. There were chutes built above the fires to carry the smoke up through the roof, but a good deal of it escaped and formed a hazy layer under the ceiling beams. Rushes crackled underfoot. Pennons, banners, crests, and shields decorated the spaces along the walls that were not covered by massive woven tapestries. At one end was a raised dais, where the lord and his special guests sat to dine. Below were trestle tables stretched down either side of the hall where knights, priests, verderers, and squires would sit, their rank of importance readily identified by how far they sat above or below the square salt cellars. Pilgrims and priests were usually well below the salt, and the lowest of all were common villeins and villagers, who ate the scraps and gnawed the bones left by their betters. It was there, at the lower end of the table, that Cassie thought she would be seated, but Rosie nudged her shoulder and pointed to the dais. Sir Thomas was seated there, slouched to one side in his chair, his head propped in his hand, a hand that occasionally rubbed his temple, indicating that he was not dozing, as she had first assumed, but that he was deep in troublesome thought. To his far left was Sir Hubert, and another knight locked in quiet conversation. To his right was an empty X-chair, and beside that another pair of knights. "Surely not," Cassie whispered. Over a fresh surge of panic, it was one thing to dream about being regarded as an equal, to long for something and someone she could never have, and to hoard such longings inside like a wretched secret never to be shared. It was quite another to walk boldly up to the dais and take a seat beside the lord of the castle and his vaunted knights. She turned and tried to dash back towards the bathhouse. Rosie's bulk blocked her path on one side, then another, until finally she grabbed her by the shoulders, spun her around, and pushed her back inside the great hall. By then the commotion had been noticed by the handful of weary defenders taking their meal between watches on the walls, and, horror of horrors, by Lord Thomas Purefoy himself, whose voice echoed angrily along the empty hall to demand an explanation. "Now you've done it," Rosie sighed. "Go on, get up there, girl, and mind everything I've told you." Chapter 3. Thomas was frowning. He was short on fighting men, but heavily burdened with villagers. They had come inside the walls, carrying only what they could gather in haste, filled with expectations of being fed and protected by their liege. His walls were tall and thick, but his harvests had been burned in the field and his stores were dwindling. Only this morning he had ordered one of the last bullocks slaughtered, so there would be meat on the table and hot broth to warm their bellies. Thankfully the well was still sweet and deep, and there was water aplenty, but the ale was running low, and he had grudgingly ordered the sensual to water it by half. Now the servants were squabbling, and the sensual who should deal with such nonsense was nowhere in sight. He recognized Rosie the laundress, but not the one she was pushing and shoving and ordering forward. As the girl came closer, he noted the green of her tunic and the tassels on her belt that danced side to side with each step she took. A gleaming cloud of blonde hair surrounded her face and shoulders, the light of the candles sparking it with gold and fiery shades of russet. Closer still, he could make out the features on her face as she passed from one pool of light to the next. Though her eyes were lowered and her mouth set in a grim line, her complexion was tanned and smooth with blushed cheeks and a lovely little nose. She was tall and slender, and there was something about the way she walked. His eyes widened and his brows lifted. It was the Fletcher's daughter, the archer. The layers of grime had been scoured away. The boyish clothes had been exchanged for a softly feminine tunic, and while her expression looked a little like a deer staring down the shaft of a hunter's crossbow, she moved with a measure of determined pride that had the other knights at the dais stopping in mid-sentence to mark her approach. Thomas stood, though he had no memory of doing so. He was on his feet when she climbed the two steps to the dais and walked towards him. Her hair flowed around her shoulders like liquid sunlight, spilling down her sleeves, so silky and fine, it fanned out in the breeze produced simply by walking. She stopped before him and dropped into a curtsy. "God's grace to you, my lord." "And to you," he murmured. Becoming conscious of the stairs from the dais as well as the hall, he indicated the chair for her to sit down, then sat again himself. Conversations around them resumed, and a lackey appeared to set a trencher of bread before her on the table. At a nod from Thomas, a goblet was produced and filled with wine. Normally, not at a loss for words, especially with the fairer sex, he found his tongue to be firmly squeezed against the roof of his mouth. She smelled of some sweet flower he could not put a name to, and he found himself sorely aching to touch a strand of that silky hair, to know if it was as soft as it appeared. His life of late had been far too busy to think of women, and his physical needs, when they pressed in upon him, had been released hither and yon with any number of castle wenches who were only too happy to oblige. He was mildly surprised to find his body reacting to the girl beside him now, reacting in such a way as to make him shift forward on the chair and reach for the platter of cold meat and cheeses. "You must be hungry," he said, with the profundity of a scholar. She raised her eyes to his for the first time, and he was stymied again. Dark, deep green they were, as clear as a still pond in the forest. "I do thank you, my lord, but I broke my fast earlier today with the other archers, and it would hardly be fair to fill my belly again while they go without. We are promised broth for supper, and so I shall be content with that." "Your intent is honourable and loyal, girl, but if De Cork's men find their courage again, and return to the catapult, and if I put you to the south tower to keep discouraging them, none will know if you have taken a piece of cheese or not."
"I will know it, my lord."
He leaned back in his big wooden chair, and regarded her with enough intensity to send varying shades of red and pink into her cheeks. "And does this virtuous abstinence extend to the wine as well?" She ran the tip of her tongue across her dry lips, and glanced at the shimmering red liquid in her goblet. "The men on the walls have only had ale, a weak and watery brew at that."
"Edward!"
His squire jumped forward.
"My lord?"
"Fetch Mistress Fletcher a stoup of weak, watery ale."
"Aye, my lord."
He hastened away to fill the command, and Thomas reached for the goblet of wine, draining half of it in a swallow. When the squire returned with a plain wooden bowl of ale, he leaned back again and waved a hand to indicate she should drink.
"You were going to tell me how you came to be such a fine archer."
She sipped from the edge of the bowl to moisten her mouth, and set it down again. "I know not where the skill comes from, my lord, aside from a keen eye and a steady hand,
Father said I could shoot the eye out of a hare when I was 4. Why was I not informed of this skill until today? Would you have done more than smile and nod and pat me on the head?
I might have. You give me little credit.
Then you should know. I can read and write as well. I can do sums, and I make the very fine paper your central uses to keep your books, letters, and journals. I speak French and Latin, though I find writing both to be a test of patience. He continued to stare for a moment, then tipped his head back and laughed. It was a deep, throated, completely masculine sound and echoed throughout the great hall, causing conversations to pause once again. Noting the interest, he stood and took up his goblet of wine.
Come with me, girl. Bring your ale.
He walked away from the board without waiting to see if she followed. With a glance round the hall, and specifically at Edward the Squire, who was attending upon her chair, she stood and dutifully followed the knight across the dais and up the staircase that led to his private apartments in the North Tower. Her nerves, by the time she climbed the winding stairs, were jangling so badly the ale was splashing over the sides of the bowl. On the upper landing, she paused to catch a full breath and steady herself. Every eye in the great hall had been upon them, and every thought behind those eyes must have been assuming he was taking her to his chambers to bed her. In truth, that was her first thought as well, and she knew not whether she should be terrified or thrilled beyond measure. He appeared at the arched doorway and frowned.
Come along, I don't bite.
She could not feel her feet, but by some inner command they moved forward. She followed him through the antechamber, where a Spartan pallet suggested that this was where his squire slept. Through another thicker oak door, she entered the main sola, a large room with a raised bed at one end, several chests, and an armory at the other, and a very tall, very wide cupboard without doors that held at least 100 books. The rest of the space was taken up by a hearth, a writing table, and a large padded chair with a tall carved back. Tapestries hung on all the walls, and there were carpets underfoot. 3 shuttered windows afforded breathtaking views of the fields and forests surrounding the castle, each with deep ledges and real glass panes. A magnificent full suit of armour stood on a wooden frame, the hauberk made of polished steel half-moons. Beside it there were 3 swords of varying lengths, a shield with a coat of arms, a helm, and various other weapons and garments of war that gleamed in oiled readiness.
When you say you can write Latin and French, I assume that means you can read both?
Yes, my lord, most of the words.
No offence, but a Fletcher would not seem to be the type to educate a son, much less a daughter.
No offence taken, but he was not always a Fletcher. And it was my mother who insisted I learn to do more than scrub pots and breed babies. She was... Cassie paused and bit on her lip.
Go on, she was.
The daughter of a Saxon nobleman and well-schooled herself.
And your father?
He was a second son, and thus studied for the priesthood. The question was in his eyes, and she answered before he gave voice to it. My grandfather was the Earl of West Saxony. His lands and titles were seized when it was thought he encouraged the barons to revolt against the Norman invaders.
And did he?
Her eyes sparkled.
Yes, proudly so.
Thomas's smile was a little crooked. And does the granddaughter of this Saxon nobleman still regard us as invaders? She offered no immediate reply, and he smiled again. Walking over to his escritoire, he searched amongst the papers for a moment until he found the one he wanted. The wax seal had been broken, and the page smudged through various attempts to cipher the words. As much as you find Latin and French to be a test of your patience, I find Saxon Englishry to be a maze of confusion. Think it would go against your grain to read it for me? It is ancient, and the script is ruined in places, but it was found along with some trinkets in this old box, which in turn was discovered recently in the wine cellars. Cassie approached the desk slowly.
Beams of sunlight were streaming through the tall arched window behind him, making tiny dust motes that were suspended in the air glitter around his shoulders. His hair gleamed blue-black, and his face was in profile, and the sight made her heart leap high into her throat. To distract herself, she looked at the box. It was old, and made of wood, banded with leather straps. It bore a sturdy iron lock that had obviously been forced open, for a jeweled dagger lay beside it, the tip snapped off.
"As stubborn and unyielding as some Saxons, I know," he murmured.
Cassie was about to offer up a retort when a stray beam of sunlight flashed off something inside the box and caught her eye. A frown creased her brow as she drew forward, and the retort turned to a small gasp. Nestled inside the box, on a scrap of velvet, was the silver mirror pendant, the one she had seen and touched not 2 hours ago. "I see he finished it," she said.
"Who finished what?"
she pointed. "The pendant. The old jewel-maker was polishing it when I went to the cellars to fetch iron for my father."
"You must be mistaken. The chest and the pendant have been in here, in my chambers, for a sennight or more. As I said, it was found in one of the empty storerooms, and I only broke through the lock last night. The parchment, the pendant, and a handful of other jewels and chains were inside."
Cassie shook her head, making the pale cloud of hair dance in the sunlight. "No, it is the same pendant. I saw your jewel-maker polishing it. There could be no two so much alike."
Thomas's eyes narrowed. "There is no jewel-maker here at Bellefontaine. What you see before you is the extent of all this castle possesses in terms of gold or silver, and that, as I said, has only recently come into my possession."
"But I saw him. I spoke to him. He was at his work table, and he—" She stopped and looked at the pendant again. She could see her reflection in the mirror, and for one heart-stopping moment she stared at her tousled blonde hair and thought it looked exactly the way—
"He what?"
She pulled her gaze from the pendant with an effort. He said the silver had come from Damascus. The stones had belonged to a Syrian prince."
Thomas scoffed. "Who has filled your head with such tales? Did he have a name?"
"Godfrey. Godfrey the Lombard, and—"
"Yes, and?"
"And he was blind." Thomas folded his arms across his massive chest and regarded her from beneath an arched eyebrow.
"A blind jewel-maker."
"But I saw him." Her voice trailed away, and she bit her lip. "I could not have imagined it. If so, then I must have imagined the other gold and silver plates, the cups, the chains." Thomas's left eyebrow arched as high as his right.
"Gold plate? Here at Bellefontaine?"
"In the jewel-maker's workroom, in the cellars. I saw them. And I touched this." She reached into the box and lifted the pendant, curling her fingers around it. "I held it, just like this, and look." She opened her palm and pointed to the scratch on the pad of her thumb, then turned the pendant over and found the tiny rough edge on the silver that had dug into her hand. "It even pricked me." Thomas was looking at her as if she had lost half her senses. "You don't believe me?"
"I don't disbelieve you. I will not be called a liar," she said, her cheeks flushing hot. "I'm not calling you a liar," he said gently, "but you have been up on a tower roof for several weeks without respite. You suffer from lack of sleep. Poor food. I saw him," she insisted flatly, the green of her eyes flashing as hot as the emeralds on the pendant.
"I saw him, and I spoke to him. His hands touched mine. He was as real as you or I." Thomas clamped his jaw to a square ridge.
"Fair enough. There is, of course, one way to verify the existence of this Godfrey the Lombard."
He took her by the hand and strode out of his chamber. She had to run to keep a pace, hair and skirts flying out behind her. His grip remained firm as he led her down the winding steps and across the dais of the great hall.
He went directly to the narrow portal that led to the covered winding steps and dragged her round and round the steep corkscrew case until they were in the cellars below. Only then did he leave go of her hand to take up a pitch-soaked torch and touch it to one of the candles in the passage. When the flames burst into life, he shoved the torch into her hand and pointed, "Show me." Cassie blinked in the bright flare of light. He was angry, and she was beginning to wonder if she had indeed suffered some loss of senses. But she grit her teeth and started off along the arched stone undercroft, followed it to the second wooden door and the guard's post. It was deserted, as it had been the first time, and she passed through, ducking her head below the lintel with a grudging hope he would fail to bend and it might scrape the hair off the top of his head. But he leaned to avoid the shaving, and soon they were walking along the smaller passage, the torch throwing enough light to scatter rats and mice well ahead of them. She held the torch up to three small doors as they paused before each, and looking for the odd little carving she had noted on her first visit. She found it on the fourth door and stopped, letting the light flicker over the depiction of the moon and stars. It was dark inside. There were no streamers of light showing through the gap along the floor, but the latch worked just as easily as it had that morning, and lifting it, she pushed the door open and stepped aside so that Thomas could enter before her. Even before the light from the torch bloomed inside, Cassie had an odd, scratchy feeling down her spine. It proved to be a harbinger of worse to come, for as she looked around, there was no sign of the work table, no shelves lined with gold and silver plate, no chains or crucibles or wires waiting to be plied into filigree. Her mouth slackened out of its stubborn tightness as she moved to the middle of the small chamber and turned a full, slow circle, the motion causing smoke from the burning pitch to stream out like the tail of a comet behind the torch. There was nothing. Nothing but decades worth of dust and cobwebs hanging in ghostly curtains from the ceiling. While she stood frozen, riddled with confusion, Sir Hubert came crunching along the passage with two other knights, all three carrying torches, their short cloaks belling out behind like great bat wings. They had seen Thomas dragging her across the great hall and had followed, anticipating some sort of trouble, for they each had their swords drawn. Seeing them, Thomas stepped out of the room and murmured a few words. After swords were sheathed again, all four knights turned and looked at Cassie. Chapter 4 I must have miscounted the rooms, she said. But although she searched up and down the corridor, going into every chamber and thrusting her torch inside to be sure, she found no other doors marked with the moon and stars, and no chambers holding the glitter of gold. When she returned to the first room, her chest was tight, and she was fighting to hold back tears of utter frustration. "He was here, I swear it. He was here in this room." "Whereas I warrant none but the rats have been here for several years," Thomas said, making a face as he swiped a sticky cobweb off his neck. "Moreover, I would think someone in this castle would know of a blind jewel-maker within the walls, but there are none."
"One-eyed Conan is the only like sight I have seen coming or going through the gates," Sir Hubert remarked from out in the corridor. "But the only jewels he works with a deft hand are the ones inside his wife's bodice."
The men shared a bawdy chuckle, and Cassie felt her cheeks darken further. "He said he comes and goes by his own gate," she said, raising her torch again and spilling the light on the wall. "Through there." Thomas peered over her shoulder.
"Through there, you say? That very solid-looking wall?"
The light had indeed fallen on a block-and-mortar wall. There was no niche, no mouse-hole opening in the solid stone facade. And yet, not quite so solid. Cassie frowned and moved closer. She ran her hand along the rough surface, her fingers tracing a line of mortar that was crumbling between two squared blocks. As she brushed it, more and more bits fell onto the floor. and when she had cleared a small section, the shape of a half-moon appeared. Feeling a renewed surge of excitement, she found a stick of wood on the floor and began scraping in earnest. After a few moments, she had cleaned a large gap behind the moon shape and uncovered a distinct groove in the stone. By now, the other knights had crowded into the chamber, adding their smoking torches to the closeness of the air. Cassie felt sweat on her brow and a stinging in her nose and throat from the smoke. But she scraped until her knuckles were raw from chafing against the stone. Still not certain what this meant, she fit her hand into the groove and pulled. She pulled again and saw a few bits of mortar spit to the floor. A third hard tug, and the solid blocks definitely moved. Thomas saw what she was about and took hold of her shoulders, moving her aside. He put his greater weight behind the effort, and in doing so nearly sent himself flying onto his ass. The solid stone blocks turned out to be but a finger's width thick, that came away with a sudden release that was as unexpected as the sight of the opening concealed behind them. Thomas straightened and stared. The other three knights craned forward to see.
"Upon my soul," Sir Hubert whispered, "it could only be a priest hole, common enough in the days of old Henry when the medicants had to creep around like ferrets."
Thomas shook his head slowly and held one of the torches in front of the opening. All eyes went to the flame and watched the black spiral of smoke, which was now being sucked to the side and vanished inside the hole.
"It's a tunnel," he said in awe. "By God's grace, it is a tunnel. Father said there was a rumour that one existed, but he could never find it."
"A tunnel? But where does it lead?"
"No time like the present to find out," Thomas said, and started to duck inside.
Sir Hubert's hand on his shoulder stopped him.
"Nor any need to muddy your finery, my lord. There could be muck and dung to slip and slide through. Leave the discovery to Sir Roger, Sir Phineas, and myself. I'll go first, and if by some miracle of Christ it leads to somewhere other than an offal pit, we'll follow and hasten back with whatever news we uncover."
Thomas grudgingly stepped aside, knowing Sir Hubert was deferring politely to his crippled foot, but he was not happy being left behind. He watched the three men duck low and enter the passageway. His gaze remained glued to the mouth of the opening until the sound of their scraping footsteps grew faint and the glow from their torches faded to black again. With barely contained excitement, he spun on his heel and started to pace the small chamber side to side. He stopped after one full pass to turn and stare at Cassie. He suspected he should offer some form of apology, but with a torch lighting her like a fiery angel, he could think of only one thing he wanted to do. He took her face in both hands and tipped her mouth up to his, kissing her so thoroughly that it left them both breathless and gasping. "By God," he rasped, "I don't know how you did it, girl. I don't know what you saw or how you saw it, but by God, it's possible you have just saved every life inside these castle walls." Her bruised lips, wet with the taste of him, remained slack, and he laughed, bowing his head to kiss her again. He took a more leisurely exploration of her mouth this time, sending his tongue around the silky smooth surfaces, inviting hers to explore in return. Ignoring the right or wrong of it, Cassie kissed him back. She kissed him with all of the passion and secret longings she had kept squirreled away inside for so long. When they broke apart this time, she did not care that her heart must be shining in her eyes, or that he could plainly see it. His gaze did not break away in disgust or amused contempt. Indeed, he relished each tremor he could feel in her body, savoured each softly panted breath, drawing on the honesty and purity of her emotions, until he felt his own filling his chest and flowing through his veins. He kissed her again, and this time his lips were warm and tender. His fingers threaded into her hair, and his body pressed gently against hers, letting her know his arousal was outward as well as inward. Her knees grew weaker with every stroke of his tongue, and she knew she would have crumpled before him had his arms not kept her upright. Feeling the hardness of his body against her, she whimpered softly. He was all muscle and strength, and before him she felt small and crushable, but in a deliciously sensual, completely feminine way. Her hands crept up to his shoulders, and then went around his neck. She would have kissed him like this forever, holding him, thrilling to feelings she had not dared to even dream about. But their solitude came quickly to an end. There were voices in the tunnel, and the light was returning, glowing soft at the opening, growing brighter to mark the three knights' return. Sir Hubert was through the portal first, his face and tunic smudged with dirt and soot from the torches.
"Praise God, it is indeed a tunnel, my lord, and it appears to lead all the way into the forest. Phineas has gone to find the end, but Roger and I thought we should return to bring back the news before you lost patience waiting."
This last was said with an eye towards Cassie's kiss-reddened lips.
"My thoughts are we have two ways to use this tunnel," Thomas said, ignoring the jibe. "We can wait until dark and lead the people out, leaving an empty castle for De Corks to throw his boulders at, or we could take a small party out and scout out his camp." Sir Hubert took offence at the first option and thus ignored it.
"Surprise would be on our side, and if he has a weakness we might find it."
Thomas nodded in agreement. "We'll take a dozen of our best knights, then."
"They will hear you clanking and squeaking 100 paces away," Cassie muttered under her breath.
Thomas frowned. "You have a better suggestion?"
Startled that he had heard her, much less acknowledged her, Cassie flushed.
"The foresters, my lord. They know the woods. They hunt in them every day, and they can move through them without rustling a single leaf."
Sir Hubert growled low in his throat.
"Foresters? They would hardly know what to look for."
Cassie looked at him calmly. "When you took a hunting party out last month, you caught a fat boar and four of her suckling pigs. When you pitched your camp for the night, how many of the sucklings did you put to the spit?"
Sir Hubert put his hands to his waist and glared.
"Two."
"And how many were there when it came to share the crackling amongst your keen-eyed companions?"
The rumbling in his chest was enough of an answer, and Cassie smiled. "The meat was perfectly roasted, though it suffered from a lack of salt. Two of your men were lying by the fire dozing. As I recall, and if you care to ask, and they care to admit, one of them was missing his poniard when he awoke."
The rumble in Sir Hubert's chest grew in volume, but Thomas held up a hand.
"All right, you have made your point. We will take a pair of foresters with us. They can scout the way ahead. Who do you recommend?"
"Rolf the Egg Eater," she said, without hesitating a blink, "and me."
"You? Not likely, girl."
"Ah, so I was useful enough when you needed my bow arm, and useful enough when I found the entrance to the tunnel, but suddenly no longer useful for going into a forest that I know as well as the lines on my hands?"
It was Thomas's turn to growl.
"Have a mind with that tongue, lest you find it pinned to the wall."
"You wished to be informed of my skills earlier," she reminded him. "Thus, with no false modesty, I inform you now that I am the best you have. Moreover, Rolf and I are the smallest. We too can move through the treetops like squirrels if need be, and scarcely bend a branch. No one thinks to look up when they are guarding a path. How do you suppose we snatched the suckling pig?"
"And if you get caught?"
"Then you lose two woodsmen rather than a party of valuable and much-needed knights."
Thomas continued to glower. He disliked fighting logic when logic went against him, but she was right. He could ill afford to lose any of his knights. If there were no weaknesses to be found in De Cox's camp, then those knights would be needed to defend his people as they escaped into the woods. He exchanged a glance with Sir Hubert, who was as galled as he to admit the girl's arguments held merit. All but one. What she failed to consider was that Thomas no longer regarded her as being expendable. His body still ached where they had touched, and his lips had not had enough of her, not by a long measure. Chapter 5. Cassie tightened the leather belt around her waist and adjusted the twin sheaths that held a brace of daggers. Her bow was slung over her shoulder,
her hair once again braided into a long, thick cord down her back. She wore clean, new hose and a short, dark green tunic made of such soft, warm wool. She kept plucking at the hem to admire it. Her boots were ankle-high, made of calf skin, with no thick soles to obstruct her ability to feel the ground beneath her feet. Rolf was similarly dressed in dark green, head to toe. He had been owl-eyed when called down from the battlements, and when he saw the four burly knights awaiting him, he all but fainted. He was young, tow-headed, and if one looked very close, one might find a score of blondish hairs on his chin. For all that, he was as nimble and quick as a fox, with bow skills that came nearest to rivaling Cassie's. Thomas had provided them with daggers from his own stores, the blades thin and honed razor-sharp. He was still not fully persuaded that this was the best way to go about gaining knowledge of De Cox's camp, but, truth be told, he could see no other way. Lustful thoughts aside, his admiration for Cassie, for her courage in volunteering to do this, knew no bounds. When it came time to escort them below to the tunnel, he felt an unaccustomed tightness in his chest. "You will take great care," he warned for the 10th time within the hour. "If you think it is too dangerous, come back. Do not take any undue risks. Do not go where you think others might fear to tread simply because you wish to prove a point, and you," he looked to Rolf, "you will ensure she heeds my words." Knowing Cassie well enough, the young forester knew he would have a better chance of catching the wind and making it obey. But he nodded and tried his best to look convincing. "Aye, my lord." That said, Thomas adjusted his own weapons and nodded to the others. He and Sir Hubert would escort the pair to the end of the tunnel. He had a thought to remain there until they returned, but Cassie warned gently that it could take hours, even a full day or more, for them to move close enough to the camp to see anything. "If we're not back by tomorrow night, at moonrise, then you will know not to expect us back at all," she said calmly. "You had damned well best be back by then," he murmured, his voice tight with the strain, "or I will burn the forest down around their heads." Sir Hubert ducked through the priest hole first, his torch lighting the way for the three who followed close behind. Cassie tried not to think too much about the narrow passage, the damp, moss-covered walls that were so close they snagged her sleeves here and there as they passed. She walked upright easily enough, but Hubert and Thomas both had to stoop to avoid banging their heads on the rough surface. Smoke from the torch streamed back into her eyes, and because the light stretched a dozen or more paces ahead of them, it startled roaches and rats, mice and other furry creatures from their evening meal of guano. The batch droppings glowed white and thick on the walls and earthen floor. Now and then they heard a squeal up ahead, followed by a flurry of wings fleeing from the light. Cassie shied from it as well, trying to use Sir Hubert's broad shoulders as a shield against the glare so as not to sear the light on her eyes. The moon was cut in half, and the trees would block another third, so there would be heavy shadows, and she could not afford to ruin her night sight. Though she began to think the tunnel would never end, it did. The ceiling rose, and the walls began to show signs of greenery, vines for the most part that had crept inside from the forest floor. The ground turned softer underfoot as they walked across the layers of half-rotted leaves that had blown in through the opening. Sir Hubert slowed his pace, then stopped. He lowered the end of the torch, nosing it into the dirt to smother the flames. The next 10 yards or so were covered in darkness, with a hand stretched out to drag on the wall and guide them the rest of the way. After passing through a thick tangle of vines and roots that camouflaged the exit, the four stood and breathed deeply of the cool, crisp air. Cassie looked all around, trying to figure out where in the forest they were standing. Earlier in the day, Sir Hubert had determined that the tunnel led in a northerly direction. She could hear the burbling sound of water nearby, so she knew they must be close to the stream that fed the cornfields. They would need a stronger marker, however, to know how to find their way back. "Rolf," she whispered, "up a tree and see what you can see." He handed her his bow and in moments had clambered up the trunk of a tall oak and vanished into the boughs above. While he did that, Cassie walked a dozen paces to either side of the tunnel entrance, looking for something familiar. She spied a rotted tree trunk broken in half in some past storm and fallen over in the shape of a slanted letter A. Directly overhead was a perfectly round patch of sky. To the left was a rocky ledge of sorts carved into the side of the hill. To the right, halfway up an alder, was an abandoned nest. Rolf appeared beside her, dropping soundlessly off a low branch. "We are less than 20 paces from the edge of the field. Just there, over the rise, less than 40 from the stream over yon." He paused to point. "I could see the glow from De Cox's main camp on the far side of the castle, that way, as well as the lesser fires of the sentries posted all around the circles of the forest. It seems we walked right beneath them."
"He'll have patrols," Thomas warned softly. "Not all of them lit for your convenience."
Cassie handed Rolf his bow, then bent and notched the string into hers. She cheeked the snugness of the quiver strapped across her back, then took out an arrow, knocked it, and fired it into the trunk of a nearby tree to leave a marker. The thwang it made, striking through the wood, seemed as loud as a shout in the silence, and startled Sir Hubert enough to rasp a curse. She held Sir Thomas's gaze a moment longer, then turned with Rolf at her heels, and melted quietly into the darkened greenwood. Thomas released a breath he had been unaware of holding. He stood for a time beside the entrance to the cave, well hidden behind a canopy of vines. Then, at Sir Hubert's urging, they retraced their steps back through the tunnel. Chapter 6. Thomas paced the night and most of the next day in his chamber, his patience stretched as thin as it could possibly be. The pale pinks and gold of the setting sun were showing through the window, and he was ready to gather all his men, return to the forest, and take their chances attacking De Cork's camp. He had not closed his eyes all night or day. Food sat untouched on his writing table. Wine was consumed sparingly, for it tasted bitter on his tongue. He had broken the prime code of chivalry by sending a mere girl out to do a man's task. Despite her boasted skills of aerial prowess, she was the daughter of a Boer, and De Cork's men were trained warriors and killers. He sat at the desk between pacings and bowed his head, raking his fingers through the dark locks of his hair. Of all the multitude of thoughts that had ravaged his mind throughout the long hours, the one he had avoided the most was how she had come to know of the tunnel's existence. She swore she had seen a blind jewel-maker at the work in the cellar, not only at work, but at work making and polishing a pendant that Thomas knew for a fact had been locked in a wooden box in his chamber for the past 7 days and nights. He glanced at the box and frowned. Releasing one hand from his hair, he lifted the carved lid and took the mirror pendant out of its velvet bag. Studying it closely, he ran his thumb over the sharp little point on the back of the setting. The one she claimed pricked her hand. Out of curiosity, he pressed against it and felt it prick his own skin. Then he stared at his thumb, watching the little bead of red blood well up. Turning the pendant over, he examined the intricate filigree of emerald vine leaves and diamond flowers. Old Godfrey the Lombard did excellent work for a blind man. With a scoff on his lips, Thomas started to put the pendant back into the box, but the mirror winked in the light and drew his eye. Bringing it close again, he saw his reflection on the polished surface. Blue eyes looked back, dark hair, a stern mouth. He drew a deep breath and held it. In the reflection, his mouth had curved into a smile, and he was looking down, down at the beautiful woman he was holding. Her head was resting on his shoulder, and his hand was lovingly stroking the long, silky yellow cloud of hair. They were both naked, lying abed, twined blissfully in each other's arms. Thomas dropped the pendant. He blinked hard to clear his head of the image he had seen, or thought he had seen, for when he dared to pick up the pendant again, he saw nothing but his own eyes staring roundly back at him. He heard a commotion outside the door and looked up as Edward ushered Sir Hubert into the chamber.
"The boy Rolf is back."
Thomas pushed to his feet. "Bring him to me." Sir Hubert turned and waved a hand. Rolf the archer, with a fondness for eggs, came into the chamber, his cap in his hand, his eyes darting this way and that as he looked around the huge room. His face was covered in dirt, his clothes were muddied, and his leggings torn at the knee.
"Where is the girl?"
"Cassie stayed behind, my lord, and sent me back."
"Stayed behind? What do you mean, stayed behind?"
"We found a good perch high up in a tree, where we could see the whole camp. We even heard some of the soldiers talking. She stayed to keep a watch and sent me back to tell you she found a chink in his lordship's armour. She'd drawed it out on a leaf with a twig." He reached under his tunic and searched a bit, then pulled out a broad green leaf. When he set it on the desk, Sir Thomas and Sir Hubert both leaned forward to study the lines that had been scratched into the living paper. Rolf used a filthy fingertip as a pointer. "The horses are picketed here, behind the camp, near to the stream, only a couple of lackeys watching them. Closer up here is the big tent where the taxman stays and drinks and pisses into the fire. He were drunk as a newt last night, roaring and cursing and waving his fist. He beat his squire with a stool because his soup ain't hot enough. Rest of the tents are spread out here." His finger followed the line Cassie had scratched onto the leaf. "The rest of the forest is here, just down out, the edge of the ravine. The men were gambling and night dicing last night, mostly fighting with each other over here." His finger shifted again. "Are the supply wagons. Between here and there, we only found 2 sentry posts and 4 men apiece. Cass said you'd as like be able to figure this out already, but..." He paused and screwed up his face, trying to recall exactly what he had been told to say. "She said if the guards by the horses were took out by surprise, then our knights could use them as beasts to attack the camp. She said a score of archers in the trees could set fire to the tents, then pick off the buggers as they ran out. Be like shooting ducks on a pond. Then your knights could ride through and finish off the ones we miss."
Thomas studied the leaf with an experienced soldier's eye, as did Sir Hubert. Neither wanted to be too quick to acknowledge that a plan devised by a girl up a tree might work, but in the end they both had to agree that it just might. At the very least, de Cox's men would be driven out of the forest and, once on the open field, there would be archers left on the castle battlements to catch them in a crossfire. Thomas made his decision and straightened. "We'll go tonight. We'll take the men through the tunnel and hopefully get them into position to catch them by surprise just before dawn. I see no other way around, but that we will have to strip the walls of every knight and leave only a small company of archers to man the defences. Hubert?"
"On my way."
And he was. He strode out of the chamber, bellowing for his squire, who was whispering in the corner with Edward. "How will we find her?" Thomas asked Rolf, his voice urgent with concern. "How will she know we are even coming?"
"She already knows, my lord. And she will find us."
Thomas had reason to recall Cassie's derision as he crouched down behind a copse of brambles and listened to the clanking, creaking, and scraping of metal on metal as his knights moved through the forest, each one as quiet as a tinker's cart on a rutted road. At least the darkness was in their favour, for the shadows were so thick he could barely see the man next to him. Compounding their blindness, a heavy layer of morning mist was forming in their dips and hollows. The men were only visible by the peaks of their helms and the small puffs of breath that rose around them. Rolf had said Cassie would find them, but how the devil would she know where to look, and how would they know if she had been caught or killed since sending Rolf back into the castle? Something happened in his chest when he allowed himself to think those thoughts. A tightness that had nothing to do with the buckles binding his chainmail or the stiffened bullhide hauberk strapped over top. He could not deny the girl intrigued him. She was brave and fearless, intelligent and shockingly lovely when she wasn't dressed like a wood sprite. It was rare for him to be smitten by a pair of soft lips and big green eyes, but smitten he was.
He turned and was about to hiss another warning to his clanking knights when he found himself staring into Cassie's grinning face. His first instinct, which he resisted, was to pull her into his arms. His second was to at least to try to sound gruff enough that she would not know how genuinely worried he had been.
"Christ Jesus, girl, where have you been? Another hour, and we would have lost the shield of darkness."
Cassie only grinned wider and stuffed a chunk of thick yellow cheese into her mouth. She had been perched all day and night, high in the treetops, watching De Cork's camp, smelling their cooking fires and listening to her belly grumble. She'd had but a few sips of water from the stream and chewed on a handful of berries after having nearly been caught once trying to filch a loaf of fresh-baked bread off the supply wagon. Thankfully, Rolf had tucked an oatcake and a wedge of cheese into his tunic for her, along with several other special items she had requested, chief among them being a supply of arrows with tips wrapped in peach-soaked rags. All of the archers were armed thus, and all carried tinder and flint and a small clump of dried grass tucked under their belts. "We'd best move quickly, my lord," she said, around the cheese. "The camp is still asleep. The few sentries have long since become bored at their posts, and most of them stand dozing behind trees."
"Rolf told me of your plan, and I approve."
"You do?" She looked so surprised he almost laughed.
"Yes, I do. I'm not half so arrogant as to ignore sound advice from someone who can steal a cooked suckling pig out from under the nose of my captain of the guards. You'll position your archers in the trees, and Rolf can lead us to the picket line where the horses are tethered. Once we are in place, and give the signal, you can unleash hellfire. I would, of course, rather it was you who led us to the horses and Rolf who took to the trees, but I suspect you would scoff at that suggestion."
"My place is with the archers," she said simply. "Most are simple villians and woodsmen who have never fought a true battle against knights, and certainly not from a distance close enough to smell their sweat. They fear the war horses, fear the men in armour who wield battle axes and swords."
"And you do not?"
She breathed a breath and whispered, "I am terrified of them, my lord, but in the trees there is some measure of safety. I keep telling myself that is so. Moreover, I know the prime targets. Moreover, I know the prime targets, and where to strike to cause the most panic. The foresters would be going in blind without me." Thomas sighed, cursing her logic again, for it went against the very grain of his soul to send her back up into those trees, not to mention every code of chivalry to which he had sworn solemn vows. Yet what choice did he have? There were 100 villagers huddled behind the castle walls, depending on him. He lifted a gloved hand and brushed the back of his fingers along her cheek. "Your courage challenges us all to be better men." Uncaring of who might be watching, he curved his hand around the nape of her neck and drew her into a deep, commanding kiss. One that sent the passion flowing through his veins into hers. When they parted, the tremors in her body ceased, and the promise in his eyes sent the pride flushing through every inch of her being. "My liege," she whispered. "My wood sprite," he smiled. Sir Hubert cleared his throat.
"We can fight and lose the day, sure as I'm standing here, but we can never win if we don't fight at all."
Thomas dropped his hand reluctantly, breaking contact with Cassie. With time and darkness fading fast, he passed the hushed orders to his men. On his signal, the small band of archers followed Cassie, vanishing like wraiths into the mist. Thomas fitted his helmet over his coif and hooked the penny-plate throat guard to his mail, and nodded to Rolf to lead them on. Just as Cassie had said, the sentries who were placed around the camp were half asleep. Most were not aware that there was death in the woods until they felt the slash of cold steel across their throats. The lackeys tending the horses fared only slightly better. They were knocked out with cudgels and sword hilts, then bound and gagged and tossed into a shallow ditch. It was accomplished with such stealth that Thomas chose not to risk the possibility of the Destriders raising the alarm with strange knights putting them to saddle. Instead, he positioned his men in a wide semicircle around the encampment, and had Rolf whistle the signal to the archers. High in the boughs of her chosen tree, Cassie heard the warbled trill and struck tinder to flint, lighting the small hillock of dried grass. The flame was small and would last only a few moments, but it was long enough to fire the pitch-soaked strip of rags tied around the arrow tips. in trees all around her, the archers were doing the same, and at her soft whistle, the arrows were knocked to bows, and the flaming darts were sent flying down upon the sleeping camp. In quick succession, she lighted and loosed three more, and when the little pile of grass burned out, she switched to the barbed arrows and waited. From less than 100 yards away, Thomas saw the pinpoints of flame raining down from the trees. Moments later, he heard shouts, then screams as tents caught fire. He rose from the mist, his sword in one hand, shield in the other, and advanced on the camp. To de Cox's men stumbling from burning tents, their heads fuddled from sleep, Thomas's knights must have appeared to be nightmares come to life with the mists swirling around them, their helmets glistening wet, the silence broken by war cries and the deadly metallic swish of chainmail. Thomas's knights swarmed through the camp, their swords hacking and slashing a bloody path. From above, a steady hail of arrows struck through chests and legs and unprotected necks as de Cox's men scrambled to find cover. The horses, smelling fire, began to scream and buck against the tethering ropes. They broke free and ran in all directions, adding to the confusion. Three charged straight through the center of the camp, their hooves trampling running men. One of the knights managed to catch a beast that was hastily saddled and tried to swing himself on its back. Seven arrows struck between his shoulders, pinning him to the leather, and when the horse bucked and thundered away, the knight was dragged alongside, bouncing and screaming. De Cox's men had no chance. The surprise was absolute. Anyone who thought to raise a sword was cut down where he stood. Those who took to a knee and raised their arm straight up to the sky were spared, and, in truth, there were more who did this than chose to die for a viper like Omfrey de Cox. Here and there were small, intense skirmishes where blood flew in ribbons and the trees shook as the horses crashed around, shaking acorns and arches from the boughs. Cassie felt her feet slip out from under her. The tree had been bent, and she lost her balance, driving a sliver of bark into her hand as she tried to keep from spilling to the ground. To no avail. She felt herself falling and tried as best she could to land clear of two knights who were charging at each other, their swords gripped, two-fisted, and swung with such force that sparks flew off the blades when they met. Cassie was driven back and sprawled across the path of a third knight, one who snarled and raised his sword over his head, intending to take hers off with the next blow. He was wearing a plain woolen shirt and hose, without armor he was vulnerable to the crescent-shaped glaive that swung out of the darkness and thudded into his back, chopping through his spine like a piece of kindling. He fell forward, landing face down on the hard earth beside Cassie. She felt someone grasp a handful of her tunic to pull her up onto her feet again. She could not see his face behind the wide nasal of his helmet, but there was no mistaking the clear blue eyes that blazed out at her. Sometimes we clanking knights can prove useful too. She sensed his grin as Thomas swatted her on the rump and sent her into the safety of the forest. A blink later, he was gone again into the swirl of smoke and mist and the pandemonium of battle. 10 minutes. 15 at most, and it was over. Thomas stood in the center of the camp and turned a full circle, his sword blade dripping threads of blood, his breath misting the air around his helmet. The face he sought was not amongst the guards kneeling before the burning scraps of their tents. De Cox's tent had been made of heavy silk and had burned fast and furious to the ground within seconds, but there was no sign of Prince John's henchmen within. Nor was he discovered amongst the bodies of the dead or wounded. And then, just as the dawn was painting the sky a watery pale blue, two of the archers came out of the woods dragging De Cox's half-dead squire between them. With a hot coal pressed over his wound, he eventually spluttered the unwelcome news that Omfrey De Cox and two of his knights had managed to get away, and were even then riding with the devil on their heels to Lincoln. Chapter 7.
We have won the skirmish, but we shall surely lose the battle.
Thomas was standing at one of the windows that looked out over the fields and forest. Lincoln is filled with men loyal to the regent, and I warrant within the week there will be a small army surrounding our walls. What will you do? Cassie asked nervously. She had been summoned to his chamber and was not entirely certain what to say, or if she should say anything at all. Sir Hubert and the others had just left, having held a small but quarrelsome council of war. Edward and Cassie had listened from the antechamber, but had not been able to make out too many of the words through the thick door. The gruff knight had glared at her on his way out, and she could not help but wonder if they blamed her archers for having let de Cork's escape. She was prepared with arguments if that were the case. They were woodsmen, not soldiers. They killed plovers and rabbits, not men. And there had been so much confusion when the fires broke out, with men and horses running everywhere.
"What choice do I have?" Thomas said, answering her question. "We have to leave. We cannot withstand another siege, and I'll not see these walls brought down and the innocent villagers slaughtered. They're too brave for such an ignoble end. No."
He shook his head and leaned a shoulder against the edge of the window casement. "We'll walk out of here and leave the gates open. The castle is too valuable a defence to destroy for no reason, and when King Richard returns sanity to his realm, it will be here for me to reclaim once the viper has had his fangs removed."
"Where will he go in the meantime?" she asked, a little shaken to think he might sail for Normandy or Brittany to await the king.
"Not far," he said through gritted teeth. "The greenwood is vast and thick, and filled with others who wait patiently for their Lionheart's return. We will join them. I will become an outlaw in my own demesne, and attack, harass, and slay whoever Lackland calls to occupy these walls. If it proves to be de Cork's, then all the better. If he attempts to plant a crop in my fields, I will burn it. If he tries to rebuild my village, I'll destroy it. If he comes into my woods to hunt me, I'll lay traps and send his head to the regent on a platter."
He glanced over and studied her for the first time since she'd come into the chamber. She had a smudge of dirt on her cheek, and her sleeve was torn at the shoulder, but, he thought, he had never seen anyone so brave or beautiful. Not knowing the thoughts kindling behind the pale blue eyes, Cassie pretended to focus her attention on picking a sliver of wood out of her hand. He frowned and beckoned her closer to the window.
"What have you done with your hand?"
She slid her hands behind her back. "'Tis nothing, my lord. A nuisance sliver."
"Let me see."
"Truly, 'tis nothing."
"If it is truly nothing, let me see."
She blew out a breath and brought her hand forward, holding it palm up. It was her right hand, and the sliver was embedded in the fleshy pad at the base of her thumb, which was awkward to pick with her left hand, especially when the fingers were trembling.
"You realize, of course," he murmured, taking her wrist and turning her hand into the light. "You are one of my most valuable assets at the moment, and should you suffer from a lack of care and attention, even for the smallest of injuries, it could entirely thwart my plans of becoming an infamous outlaw."
"I am? I mean, I could?" He plucked the sliver out with a minimum of effort and showed it to her before flicking it away.
"Your bow arm is needed, a most precious asset, as is the hand that guides the arrows," he said, and raised her palm to his mouth, pressing his lips over the tiny bead of blood that appeared to fill the prick hole left by the sliver.
"And I could scarcely step a foot inside that forest without becoming hopelessly lost if you were not by my side."
"Oh."
The word came out more as a breath than a sound.
"Yes. Oh."
His lips moved to her wrist. "And since this precious bow arm is attached to this shoulder, and this shoulder is attached to this neck, and this neck to, well, everything you are, and everything that humbles me to the core," he said, drawing her slowly into the hard circles of his arms. "It behooves me to take very good care of every part of you." Cassie's lashes shivered shut as she felt his lips exploring the soft crook of her neck. Her senses were spinning, her body was hot and cold at the same time, tingling everywhere his hands brushed or touched. Her head fell backwards, and his lips were there caressing and exploring, travelling up the slender arch of her neck to her chin, her cheek, the tender underside of her ear.
"Please," she gasped, "my lord." I am not a lord any more. He chuckled softly against her ear. I am soon to be but a humble outlaw. But if you would have me stop, if my attentions are unwanted... He straightened a moment, and the pale eyes stared down into hers.
By God, I never thought to ask if you even found me the least bit appealing. I never thought to ask if your affections were promised to another. I never...
Cassie whimpered softly, curling her fingers into his hair, and dragged his mouth down to hers. Any doubt he may have had was silenced through a kiss that ended with his body hard and the hands eagerly tearing at each other's clothes. At the first press of bared flesh, he swore a soft oath and scooped her into his arms, then carried her the few short paces to the bed. There, while she wiggled and twisted her way out of her leggings and tunic, he stripped off his own garments and flung them aside. Naked, he joined her on the bed, and without reservation she parted her thighs to welcome the heaviness of his body between them. Cassie had never lain with a man before, but she had certainly seen many a furtive coupling on the castle battlements these past few weeks. Her body was trembling, her heart was pounding in her chest. She had to curl her lip between her teeth to keep from crying out as she felt the solid heat of his flesh probe between the silky soft folds and began to stretch up inside her. The cry turned into a husky groan as he pushed deeper and deeper, filling her, joining their two bodies together as one. Her head pressed back into the bedding with her hands reached out at either side, grabbing at twists of the blanket. He was buried deep inside her. His lips were on her neck. She could feel his heart beating as wildly as her own. His hands skimmed down from her waist to her hips and lifted them, causing her to gasp and writhe as she realized there was more, so much more. With his guidance, she moved her body for him, opened herself wider, squeezed herself around him until his breathing was as ragged as her own. When the spasms began, she let go of the bedding and clawed her hands around his shoulders. She moved with his thrusts, straining eagerly to meet each one, crying out, gasping, clinging to him as the pleasure exploded through her body. It was Cassie's turn to stand at the window deep in thought. Full night had fallen. The sky was a vast black vault, awash with stars. They had been abed since late afternoon, and, as if to make up for the haste of their first coupling, Thomas had been taking his torturously sweet time, bringing her to orgasm time and time again. She could feel the pearly slickness on her thighs, evidence of her most recent surrender to his skills. At some point during the evening, her hair had become loosened from the braid, and now fell in a pale yellow tumble around her shoulders. Once, when Edward had interrupted to bring food, she had snatched a robe from a wall peg and wrapped it around her shoulders, the same robe she wore now to guard against the chill from the open window. Aside from that, the two had remained blissfully naked and twined in each other's arms all evening. Hearing movement behind her, she half turned, but Thomas was already there, sliding a hand around her waist to draw her back against his chest. He buried his lips in her hair and nuzzled contentedly for a long moment. "You are full of surprises, my lovely wood sprite. First you show me your talent with a bow, then your courage at venturing out into the forest at night to watch an enemy's camp. You show me intelligence by turning leaves into maps and cleverness in planning an attack that could have gone so very horribly wrong. If that were not enough, you bewitch me, body and soul, and keep me locked away in this tower for hours that should have been spent planning how to begin my life as an outlaw."
"I saw no lock on the door,"
she protested through a smile, trying not to notice that his hand had slipped beneath the robe and slid deftly between her thighs. "The lock is here," he murmured, using his finger to win a soft sigh from her lips. "And you notice I said nothing about your opportune meeting with old Godfrey the Lombard. Without that, we would still be walking the walls waiting for the next attack."
"I cannot explain what I saw," she said. "I only know I saw it. I saw him. He was as real as you are now. His hand touched mine. and it was real flesh and blood, I swear it.
I believe you. I believe you saw something because it happened to me too.
Cassie turned around so swiftly, his hands were nearly broken off at the wrist.
What did you say?
He withdrew his hand from the folds of the robe and flexed his fingers.
I was understandably embroiled with other thoughts at the time and not exactly certain what I was seeing in the reflection, but now, after tonight.
Her eyes grew round and dark.
What did you see?
This, he said, indicating the bed, you and I together, naked and blissful in each other's arms. Cassie glanced past his shoulder to the shadowy corner where his writing table stood. She looked back up into his face, a face so sinfully handsome. She had never dared even to hope. The Lombard's ghostly words came back to her then, brushing past her ear like an errant breeze, having no substance, no sound, just the impression of being there.
"He told me what I saw was my own heart," she whispered. "My heart's fondest desire."
He studied her face a moment, then showed her what he held in his other hand. It was the jeweled pendant, and as she caught sight of her own reflection, she realized the robe she was wearing, his robe, was the burgundy embroidered with threads of gold. A slow smile of wonderment spread across her lips, as she recognized it to be the same image she had seen the first time she had looked into the oval mirror.
"What do you suppose it means?" she asked.
He slipped the chain over her head and lifted the cloud of her hair free so that the pendant lay against the burgundy silk and reflected the contented smile in his own face.
"I only know that the old man spoke the truth, and I have found my heart's desire."
She sighed and rested her cheek against his shoulder. She felt the heavy pendant crush against her breast, and as she lifted it to the side, she glanced down and into the mirror again. She closed her eyes briefly and looked again, but the image had not changed, and what she saw there caused her to nuzzle her face back into the warmth of Thomas's neck.
"I think old Godfrey is working his mischief again."
"Why, what did you see?"
She raised up on tiptoes and pressed her lips to his, murmuring through a grin as their breaths and tongues entwined.
"I saw something that might well frighten you more than any life as an outlaw."
He frowned and held her away a moment. "How so?"
"Allow me to say that I hope you like children, my lord. A good many handsome little yellow-haired children."
Thanks so much for allowing us to share this, Marsha. I really liked it because it reminded me about my first adventures into the romance genre. I remember sneaking into my parents' shop and borrowing the historic fiction from the shelf to devour. Tell me, what was your first foray into romance fiction? Mills and Boone? Historic? Regency? What did you think of this piece? Leave a comment at rompod.com and I'll read out the best ones. There you can also locate the show notes, which includes links to our featured author, and if you've enjoyed this story, please recommend this podcast to your friends. Come out of the romance closet and help me share the love. There's always room for more lovers of romance. We are currently looking for authors and narrators, so if you're interested in being a part of RomPod, please contact me, amanda.rompod@gmail.com. With special thanks to my husband, Simon. That's it from me. I've been your host, Amanda McCall. Thank you for joining me, and we'll be back next week with our story, The Angel and Her Gun, by Kate Copesley. Please remember, whenever you can, share the love. This podcast is shared under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. You may distribute, display, and copy this work, but not for commercial use. You may not alter, transform, or build upon this work in any way, and if you use it, you must link to the original work. The stories within each episode remain copyright of the authors. RomPod is created using the Audacity editing software. The music used in each episode is sampled from Tango di Manzana by Kevin MacLeod. Find his work on incompetech.com.